I remember picking up the phone once, and for every one name that appeared in the story, there were 10 soldiers talking to us whose name never appeared in the story, who would call with tips, and who we would call and say, hey, did you hear this happen? We heard Jeremy Duncan, who Dana mentioned before, who lived in the crummy room in Building 18. He had lost an ear in Iraq, and he was blown up on the side of his body. But he's a very laid-back, funny guy, and we hadn't seen him for a while. We're like, hey, where's Duncan? His name's Jeremy Duncan. Oh, Duncan had to go get a new ear. I mean, this is someone calling. What's new? It's a little gossip. Duncan had to go get a new ear. He had gone out in D.C. one night and tried to go dancing, and his ear fell off, and someone stepped on it. So, all right, well, Duncan's getting a new ear. But so at the end of the conversation, you know, they say, oh, by the way, we heard someone died last night at Delano Hall, which is another barracks on Walter Reed. And so, you know, at the end of that conversation, we learned that a soldier had overdosed, and that's something for us to check out. But that only came to us because we had kind of this whole network of soldiers and Marines calling us all the time, and we babysat them, checked on them, and it was just a really intense relationship all that time. One thing we decided to do was, you know, one issue was over-medication for these soldiers, and they were getting stiffed by the Army's Disability Board. This is when you come back injured, and the Army assesses you to decide how much retirement pay it's going to give you. Some of these guys were getting 0%, even though it was clear they had been injured in Iraq. One such guy was named Del McLeod. He was a very heavy-set National Guard member from South Carolina. He had been on the border in Iraq, and a steel cargo door had hit his head, and he had serious cognitive issues. And so his wife moved to Malone House to take care of him, and it was like having a child. He could not function on his own. And he was, you know, we looked at his medical records. He's taking 12 or 13 medications a day. They're interacting in bad ways. You know, it's one thing to look at someone's medical records and say there's some cognitive problems, but it's another to go to his room at Malone House and see that his wife had tied on a blue ribbon to the door. Why? Del couldn't remember his room, even though he'd been living there for a year. I mean, the tricks that people employed to survive were unbelievable, and it's stuff you can't find in medical records or even if they're talking to you. They don't think to tell you. So we decided to spend the night in that room, and what do you get from one night? It yields a whole bunch of stuff that ends up in the story. You watch, you know, Del kind of half-zonked watching, you know, World Wrestling Federation while his wife is trying to talk to him. They have this ritual where they're sitting on the bed every night, and they go through his 12 medications. And, you know, to watch a man take 12 pills at night, and then to watch them wake up in the morning for formation, you know, Annette has to creep up behind her husband and shake him from behind, because a guy who's back from Iraq usually wakes up swinging because he has some sort of, you know, traumatic stress disorder. But you have to see that with your own eyes, and you can't have someone tell it to you. And that's one reason why the story was time-consuming, but it's also a reason that we hope that it popped to life in ways that traditional investigative reports often don't.
Before we talk about writing, I just wanted to add a couple of quick things to that. So in documenting this world, we did several things, if you break it down into categories. One is to see things firsthand, not just be told about them. But and the second is to be told about them, either things that were required us to then go reconstruct what had happened. There's kind of, it wasn't a tension, but Anne was less likely to go for that route. Again, I'd covered the CIA where I wasn't near anybody doing anything real time, and my whole life as a reporter had to do with reconstructing things. So when you do that, you know, you have to validate them with other sources. And we had, so that leads to another vein of reporting, which is that we did have a group of insiders who could help us validate stories that individual soldiers were telling us about either themselves or rumors that they heard. So we were operating in that way on several different levels. And then we would always ask people for their medical records when we got to know them and when they agreed that they would help us. So we were trying to get any kind of documentation that we could. And finally, let's talk about editors for a minute. You know, I think that the Post is probably among the best in allowing reporters a lot of freedom, but it's creeping into being something else. And my view on the relationship with editors is that reporters, you know, have to drive that relationship. They have to be the ones who determine what is the story and what the story is like. I mean, you have to do it with a lot of diplomacy and a lot of respect, but, you know, you're the ones that are out there in the world, and they aren't. So in this regard, we really tried to stay below the radar of many people, army officials and editors in a way too, because in the beginning we really didn't know exactly what we were seeing. And I remember we went in to describe in the beginning, because of course they're wanting to know, well, what are you doing? Well, what are you up to? What is this that you're... And trying to describe it just didn't work all that well. And because we had just a series of anecdotes, and then there's this, and then there's that, and we didn't know the system that well, and I just remember the editor sitting back and furrowing the brow and sort of saying, okay, well, we'll get back, you know, we'll have a better sense of it later, and then tried really never to have a later until the end. And obviously not everybody's in that position, but we were. And so it's just the lesson to me, again, is you have to be diplomatic, you have to be respectful, you have to give editors something, because they're going to be talking to other editors above them wanting to know how you're using your time. But it's really important that reporters stay in the driver's seat of what's going in the paper or on documentaries or what have you. So we did want to talk about writing a little bit.
Yeah, I really feel like it's impossible to talk about writing in some ways. It's the most treacherous, awful, you know, thing that we ever have to do, and it's just hell. Tom French and I have this game we play. How many is it? Cheetos and Fritos. When you're writing, you know, how many trips to the vending machine do you go to that day? We don't have much time. Let's put aside the writing conversation. I just want to say that we both wrote our own sections. We both wrote our stories. Dana wrote one day, I wrote the next. And then you go through that inevitable process of having to redraft. And we redrafted a couple times on this story with the great help of David Marinus, our editor, which kind of helped the pieces have a unified voice. We didn't think so much about creating a beautiful piece of writing as we did accomplishing a goal, and that is to expose what the Army was doing. So we were not super conscious of the writing per se, other than the organization of it, to maximize our anecdotes and to hit certain themes and kind of tie it up that way. We can talk privately about writing later. I want to talk a little bit about, we call this the showdown interview, and I want Dana really to talk about it, because I was more of a passenger and she was in the driver's seat on this process. We don't, in our world of writing, you know, usually at the end we have questions for people, but they tend to be verifying facts. We're doing our fact checking, we're making sure we've got everything right, you know, sequential, age, theme, all this stuff. But this was, you know, a more traditional setting in that we had to go to the Army and confront them with everything we'd found out the last 4 months. And we were off the radar. They didn't know we'd reported. They didn't know we'd spent time on post even. And in fairness, we wanted to give the Army more than the typical, you know, Friday you fax over a set of questions and they have to respond for their Sunday publication. So Dana, understanding the culture of the Pentagon, wanting to give them ample time, I think called on a Monday or Tuesday before our Sunday publication.
Right, and I called somebody who I had had a good relationship with and said, in the nicest, in using humor way that I could, we have this story we've been working on for a little while. You aren't going to like it necessarily, but, you know, I just want to tell you what it is, and so we can get your reaction eventually. And in the middle of describing, you know, he was saying, oh my, oh dear, oh. He said, I got to get this other person on the line, Cynthia Vaughn, who was the press person for the Army Surgeon General, who I didn't know. And so again, I tried that same, my general approach to people is really to always be nice and to meet bad news with you know, courtesy and niceness and humor, unless they're going to be an idiot about it. And then, you know, forget it. But most people would rather deal with you in that way, and you get a lot more out of it. So while she was on the phone, not knowing me, I was also trying to do that. You know, the first public affairs person says to her, Cynthia, you might want to lock the window. by the time we finished, you know, describing it, she says, I'm on the floor. But she wasn't angry. you know, and there wasn't, it wasn't like the doors were closed and no one was yelling, you know, how could you? This is all inaccurate. Because in fact, they didn't really know whether it was inaccurate because they didn't know the world of Walter Reed that we had come to know. So we wrote out, and this is like typical, you know, military request, but it would go for any government or company or whatever that you're interviewing or you're, the subject is your subject. Can you send us an email with the questions? Which we used to not have to do that, but so we had 30 questions, and we went. What we did is we went through the story. We didn't tell them any names. We didn't tell them how we did the story or anything like that. We had 30 questions that, as we looked through the stories, they would be things. Maybe we picked everything we could think of that they should fairly be able to respond to.
How many caseworkers do you have per soldier, that kind of thing, to show the staffing inadequacies, that kind of thing?
And that went from the Army over to Walter Reed, but it also went right up to DOD, you know, Rumsfeld's public affairs apparatus, and binged around everywhere, which, you know, I knew was going to happen. And that's why we had to, you know, we went at the end, but we did give them 4 days, which, you know, for a daily story would be crazy, but for a story like this, it's not. It's a fair way to do it. We didn't tell them about Building 18 yet. We told them everything else. And then they said the Walter Reed commander wanted to respond, come on over. So here we'd been in this place going in and out freely. Do you know how to get here? Do you need a map? Would you like an escort? Well, there'll be a car to escort you once your car, you know, and they gave it, fine. So we had an escort vehicle pull us up, and it was winter, and one of the things we learned being there was that they weren't shoveling the sidewalk so that the wheelchairs could get through. And so there were people trapped in their rooms who were just afraid to go out because of the ice. And here we pull up with an escort, and there's a big snowblower snowblowing us a parking space, and our names are clearly up there, you know, Miss Hall, Miss Priest. And we go into an interview with the commander, Brigadier General, very nice guy, General Waitman, and 8 colonels are there. And the colonels are all sitting in back of us, which I, you know, that is all about screwing with your mind. And Anne's got on, you know, I've got my navy blue suit on now because I'm walking into my old world, and Anne's got this feather jacket, the down jacket that she bought, and I noticed that all the feathers are coming out and floating around.
I had bought something on sale. Yes, it's true. So I'm wearing it was winter. I'm working. And so I was in this down jacket, and for some reason, all the goose feathers started coming out, and the heater is blowing on us. So I'm like a chicken. And like, you do the talking.
And we went through everything, you know, and we had what would be a typical interview. It was all very nice. They realized, you know, we really knew what we were talking about. Waitman was a complete professional at this. He didn't get angry. He tried to put the best face on it without lying. And then when we were leaving, I said to him, again, because I'd covered the military so long, I know what they hate more than bad news is not knowing that the bad news is coming. So I said, you know, I just want you to know that we have been up here, and that's, you will see that in the story. And he says, okay, and then he says, so I suppose you're not coming to the press conference tomorrow. And I'm like, what press conference? And it turned out that they put on a preemptive press conference, which ended up kind of backfiring because the reporters couldn't figure out why they were calling this because they didn't tell them it. But they eventually got him to admit that there was a Washington Post story. So all these Pentagon reporters are now really pissed. They're like, what, we're your mouthpiece? And they boycotted doing stories until our story came out. Then we told them about Building 18 the Saturday before the Sunday. Now, why did we wait? Because we wanted the full burden of and the full weight of what had been going on to be in the paper. And we didn't want to give them a chance to clean it up and to say, you know, well, it's since been cleaned up. And I, you know, I thought a lot about, is that fair? And I totally think it's fair. Because every day we had this talk, you know, they're probably going to find building, you're probably going to clean building 18 up. You know, we really thought, we'd been there 4 months, we thought for sure they would clean it up because it wasn't that hard to clean up, and they never cleaned it up. So by that time, you know, we felt very fair in telling them at the last minute, and got a, you know, I'll go right over there, ma'am. And they went over there and they came back and they gave us eventually that afternoon a statement which included the fact that their roach and rodent abatement program had started, you know, several weeks ago, and they believed that it was making great progress.
So we are ready for questions.
First of all, thank you very much. Not just for this presentation, but for the work you do. Okay. There aren't that many stories that make you proud to be a journalist, but this sure is one of them, so thank you. One of the most amazing things to me, and you've described your process in some detail, but I still don't understand, how is it that you flew under the radar for that long and that somebody didn't, I mean, were you amazed yourselves that somebody didn't put the kibosh on you months before?
Not after, I mean, before I would have said, yeah, that's not going to last. But once we went in, no, because it's a big place. People are worried about their own lives. There are people not in uniform all over, family members, mothers, daughters. I mean, the worst was when we would have this, okay, are they going to think we're their sister or their mother? And it's the way you move about. You know, I know that once you've been embedded in a place, you get to know the place and you feel confident about being there. And so it's somewhat about your manner of being in a place in which you don't stand out. And leaving the room, if there's a lot of people, leaving a room when someone walks in who might be a little bit more aware of who should be there and who shouldn't and sees an unfamiliar face. So there were times, a lot of times, when we did that, when we didn't go somewhere or we left somewhere.
The other thing is, you know, we made sure, we stressed with each person we talked to, please don't tell anyone you're talking to us, especially your supervisor, but other people. And if you see us in public, don't acknowledge us.
But many of the soldiers didn't really realize that, you know, the Washington Post might, you know, what does that mean to have a Washington Post reporter? So you're a reporter that shows up in a very sympathetic way, not looking like a typical reporter, and, like, they don't really know what you're doing, and you're talking to them in a very subtle way. And so, yeah.
We should do the one in the back. We'll stagger the questions.
Can you talk a little bit about scheduling? Were you working on other stories as you were working on this? How often were you there? Were you there once a week, every day? And how often did you write? Was it at the end you just wrote it all, or did you keep on writing little bits over the course of the 4 months?
Scheduling. We pretty much lived and breathed that story for 4 or 5 months. And even after publication, we lived and breathed it because of the outpouring. We had to, you know, for every email that came in, there was often a tip in there, and we had to follow it up. So it kind of never has stopped, really. It still goes on. But we were up there all the time. There's two of us, and one reason we often went separately is because we could accomplish twice as much work, and if one got caught, it's better than two getting caught. So there was a strategy to how we kind of went into the place. And we just reported like crazy for about 3.5 months, and then spent, I would say, a month writing and redrafting, but continuing to report while we're writing, and it's getting redrafted and edited.
Were you continuously writing, like, your notes and stuff like that?
Well, we're both pretty good about keeping up with our notes, and we're both very organized. So when we would have a full notebook, we had a day of reporting, we'd transcribe that night, and then we'd share with each other what we had. So everything was open between us, and we'd talk, you know, 15 times a day. If I went 2 hours without talking to her, it was really strange. And it still is really strange. You know? Yeah.
But we did have notebooks that we tried to keep, I mean, notebooks that were of transcribed notes, so that we could both look at it and electronically, but when we sat down to write, they were also in notebooks. So that, you know, I would know what she would know and vice versa, because there were tips within each of our reporting that led, you know, you then ask that question of someone else, and that's why I really love to work with other people, because when you're in a hard area like this, you know, the more sources and the different sources, the better.
Hi. Yeah, I was going to ask about sort of the technical aspect. You've just said that your notebooks were transcribed from, and I was wondering what kind of equipment you went in there with, what kind of tape recorders? Did you have tape recorders? Is that what it is? They don't search you for that or anything like that? Did you have cameras yourself? At one point it sounds like you did. Did you have any kind of video material? And what kind of technical backup do you need at your paper when you're doing an investigative article like this?
I think we were both pretty low tech. I don't really like tape recorders because then you have to listen to the tape, although I know that that's a good thing and you get re-immersed in it. We, you know, we took notes in certain ways when we were there. So, okay, we don't want to draw attention to ourselves, but you have to write things down so you all can kind of figure out how you might be able to do that. And then we would, we did tape record some interviews with people that we had off post. And because there was so much, you know, we had to learn the bureaucracy. This is all about a bureaucracy failure. So, God, who wants to learn about a bureaucracy? And then you got to learn about the Army, you know, or relearn about the Army structure. So there were a lot of details that we could scribble down, but they were still so murky. That was why sometimes it was good to have a tape recorder. And then we had some inside sources who could explain, well, how are the brigades organized and who are the platoon sergeants, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, we, other than that one time with the camera, we didn't take cameras because, or notebooks or other things that would identify you if you did get caught and someone wasn't thinking you're a reporter, they're just wondering, well, why are you there? Or maybe someone asked to look in your bag, which did happen, you know, you just wouldn't have things that would stand out as identifying you at the paper. And then hopefully they wouldn't ask, well, who are you with? I mean, like, what organization are you with? If you were with another soldier, there you are. You're with another soldier. You got to brief the soldier so they don't lie about who you are. But maybe they don't totally disclose who you are either. And so finding that phraseology is the key.
Wondering about the editing process and the rewriting process. What role did David Marinus play, and how long did that take from your initial drafts to the drafts that went into the press? And were there things in your final stories that just didn't get in that you wished had gotten in?
Our process, we both, Dana took the first day, which was the macro day, and I took the second day, which was kind of a micro look at the Malone House. And we combined anecdotes and shared reporting, but she essentially wrote day one, I wrote day two. David Marinus said, come up on a Saturday afternoon, let's see the drafts. And he looked at the drafts, and then we sort of reorganized everything on a legal pad as to how to maximize the information. And then we rewrote the story from there, and then we probably rewrote it one more time. And he would, you know, it's a real blessing and privilege to have three of us in an office at the Post, like a week before publication, to work at it with a wordsmith like Marinus, because he cares about each word. And we are just all at the computer looking at each word, each sentence. And that's the funnest part of the job, to make sure it comes out right. And so I would say that period took maybe 3 weeks to do.
No, it was not the funnest part of the job for me. You know,
when she doesn't, yeah.
I could, you know, there were times when the three of us were in there and they were, you know, arguing over a verb or, you know, whether to use what pronoun or a name. You know, I can see Anne's eyes lighting up and really getting into this. I just had to leave. You know, I'll go get some coffee. I'll come back later. And the other thing I learned as mainly a beat reporter who wants to just, like, hit you on the head if I can right there in the beginning, and also I have an editor saying, you got to have your nut graph either in the second or the first graph. So I did that in my initial draft, which is I had, you know, many clauses in the first several paragraphs. I probably had, you know, cockroaches and George Bush in the same paragraph. Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, and Marinus is the opposite, and I think we found a middle, but he, you know, unpack. So that's the word I learned, is unpack. I'm still, working at that, but not only unpack, but then you have to give context in a way that, what is this world? Before you get into how it's broken, unfortunately, you have to describe the world, which to me is like, come on, let's get through that so we can get to the broken part. No. You're not going to get the impact unless you can describe the world, and then you have to describe it in a way that's fun and easy to read so you don't lose people before you get to what I want to really get to. So that took patience, which is not a virtue of mine, but I'm learning.
So it sounds like you did a fair amount of reporting where you didn't tell people who you are. I'm talking about the people you were, with.
Can you get closer?
Yeah. It sounds like you did a fair amount of reporting where you weren't telling people that you were sort of operating amongst who you were. And so I'm just wondering, how do you handle having conversations with people, so long as they don't ask you who you are? So how do you handle those conversations, or the ones where you were out with the smoking people and just listening? How do you handle them in terms of being able to use that stuff? I mean, I can understand if it's someone who you later had a relationship with, and by that time you can go back to that. But let's say you were, working on a daily story and you didn't have time to develop that relationship. Let's say you got caught and you got kicked off and that was the end of your interviewing.
This is a question that comes up all the time. I mean, if you quote someone by name that they know you're quoting them by name. When we were hanging out and listening, the first stage, without notebooks, obviously none of those quotes ever appeared in the story. We can't remember what someone said and put it in the story. But when we did bring the notebooks out, anyone who was quoted in the story knew that we were reporters working on a piece for the Post on Walter Reed. There was only a brief scene in one of the days where we were hanging out in the bar and ended up quoting some people because I had something to write on and wrote down verbatim what the dialogue was, but we did not identify those people. We made sure that they couldn't be identified when we had the quote in there, but everything else is completely attributed. It has to be.
So it's a way of gathering information about the world you're entering and you don't know all the dynamics of it, and it's a way of maybe identifying people that you do want to approach and say, I'm a reporter and, can we talk? So a lot of it, again, doesn't get in the story, but it's a way of building sources, an atmosphere that you're going to describe also. There's privacy rights involved, and so we were never going to put somebody's name or even descriptor with a blind quote or a feeling or even in the story that could be identified unless that person allowed us to do that. Because, people, we have to respect that, and people up there don't want necessarily everybody to know they're there even. So we had to use those rules.
I'm curious about what you were talking about earlier about patience and then also about restraint, because it sounds like you had all these great sources or subjects that you were looking at. How do you decide, when to sort of wait and go for, a different source, the better subject, and when to pull the trigger on a story or a particular person that you're writing about?
Well, I sort of conceive of it as rings. You have the outer ring of people who are you've been introduced to them by somebody, they are friendly, and they're not going to out you because of whatever reason, many different reasons. But then getting to the next ring, so you're working towards the middle. If you could have anything you'd want, you'd go sit down with a bunch of people and ask them questions and they tell you the truth, and some of them would be right in the belly of the beast and others would, but you don't have that. So you're working towards that. And so the second layer is people that you aren't sure whether they're going to be friendlies, but you think maybe they are. And like we both made blind calls at that stage to names we had been given, but we weren't sure whether those people would go and tell the higher, the officials of Walter Reed. So that is very frustrating because you think you could get what you need, but you want to make sure you have everything out here first because you could be putting yourself at risk. And we talked a lot about that. Should we, pop our head up at all? Should we wait? And that's why it took so long, because we did a lot of waiting. And then when we got to that second ring, it was also, then you sequence the calls you make, because You want to start with the people that all your information says are not going to go to authorities. Maybe they don't want to talk to you, or maybe they do, but they're not going to then out you. And that is just getting as much information about the person that who you don't know as you can, their relationship to the institution that you're going to talk to them about, and then not giving them or deciding how much information about what you're doing to give them. So there were some people who you could say, we hear that there are problems, even though you know that there are problems. You know, we hear that there are problems. So you're not revealing everything you're doing, the largeness of everything you're doing. I remember one person, a couple people said, you need to go to public affairs when you're in this middle, when we got to this middle. You need to go to public affairs. And so I would say, well, then you're kind of like stuck. Well, I'm not really going to do that yet. We don't know what we're going to do with this or when. Just, we'd appreciate it if you didn't either. And you're just then hoping that they didn't. But one person, this one bad interview that I had was with the person who was like close to the center, probably in the middle ring, had a lot of incriminating information, including information that they were involved in. And unfortunately, I got them to go to dinner, and it was clear within 5 minutes that they were not going to tell me anything. So then I had to sit through a dinner making small talk. But that didn't really happen that often.
Thank you.
Thank goodness.
I have a pretty simple question, actually related. I'm wondering how you know when to stop reporting, because you're amassing all this information, you're collecting these details, and at a certain point, you could keep going on indefinitely. So do you impose a deadline on yourselves at a certain point, or how do you know when it's time to sit down and write?
It's hard to explain, but I always equate it with like you just had a buffet and you're so full you can't eat anymore. You just kind of have this sense inside that you've got most of what you set out to get, and plus some surprises. And in this story, working against us was that someone else could do the story. So that was the main thing to make us stop our reporting. We knew we had good stuff. We had it confirmed. It's time to write. And then the real pressure comes, is someone else going to beat us to the story? And that's the anxiety that you kind of live with constantly, especially on this one.
You had mentioned earlier that a lot of the soldiers and their families really weren't kind of clued in on what you were doing. And that's the reason why this story didn't break. No one, they're all part of this larger thing that they really didn't know how to relate to it. But with this war and more as we get into the more soldiers are educated, have college educations, they might be writers themselves. I think there are statistics, there's more soldiers now that have book deals. You didn't stumble upon any soldiers or any soldier's family that thought to themselves, wow, okay, this is a chance, something bad is happening, I have a chance to be part of something, publish a book on my experience doing this. Or someone who sort of positioned themselves to be the star, knowing that, this might be a chance to take advantage of something bad that's happening to them. I'm wondering if anything, in this world of citizen journalism and reality TV shows, why there wasn't, out of all these hundreds upon hundreds of people, no one sort of took advantage of that.
Well, we later learned after the story's published that there's an awesome guy blogging from the Malone House. He's an injured Marine, I think. We didn't even realize that was going on. And he was detailing over medication and things like that. But we just didn't find anyone who was doing that. Plus, there's a mythology about Walter Reed that everybody wants to kind of keep alive. And that is, it's a place of great medical care for our nation's heroes. And I don't think people wanted to pierce that, which is why it took so long for some people to have the courage to step forward and speak out against their army and against Walter Reed.
Yeah, it's the army. I mean, it's the army culture. It's just, you wouldn't speak publicly about it. You wouldn't, it's very tricky to even speak beyond your next chain of command. Now it's a little bit different. But then, why did it last for 5 years before we did it? Because people were not thinking about going outside. I remember One of the main characters in the story, and whose picture was on the front day, Staff Sergeant Shannon, which is a fairly high rank, and he was a team sniper leader in addition. So he had a very risky and responsible job. And his eye had gotten blown out from an Iraqi sniper. And we talked with him. He was so articulate. He could tell us so much about the system. And we talked to him for a long time, many times. And it wasn't until maybe the sixth time when we felt like we needed to say, okay, can we get you to go on the record with any of this? And it was a very nerve-wracking question that, you know, how are we going to pose this right, you know, so that he doesn't say no. And he looked at us like, you know, you have to be crazy. Of course I'm going to go on the record. I am a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army, and my army is not supposed to be treating people this way. And he had had this experience where a young soldier, and staff sergeants are in charge of the lives of the soldiers, you know, not necessarily, you know, what they're going to do in battle, but what they're going to do when they're not in battle. And they're like their mothers, really. And he had a young troop down the corridor who had killed himself because he wasn't getting care. And that sparked him to do all sorts of things, but not ever to think about going outside of his chain of command. So that's just, I mean, that's military culture. That's the, you know, agency culture. Wasn't going to happen. And it didn't happen. And even when people came to them, Don Rumsfeld and his minions came there and asked, how are you doing? Nobody really told them. I mean, they might tell them their story about their disability rating or their leg, but they're not telling them that my entire platoon is screwed up and there's a wounded soldier who cannot remember my name because he's brain injured. Because that's then ratting on the institution, and that's not...
We're going to need to close it now. Thank you so much, Dana and Anne.